The last case set for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the estate of Russell Tank. On behalf of the appellants, Daniel Bentro is present, will be arguing. Robert Trzenska is also present at council table. And on behalf of appellee Jason Bender, Reed Rasmussen is present and arguing. Before we start, I just want to note that Judge David Knopf, First Circuit Judge, is sitting with the court in place of Justice Myron, who recused himself on this case. So we appreciate Justice Knopf's willingness to serve with the court on the case. So, Mr. Bentro, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, counsel, and the law school guests. This last case before the court this term, this session, is a will contest case, a challenge to a probate document. It's a statutory remedy that allows an interested party to challenge a will based upon testamentary capacity or other reasons such as undue influence. This case has been up to this court before. This court is very familiar with all the facts. For the benefit of the audience, I would like to add just a few that are not included in the court's packet. Perhaps the most shocking fact for which we begin with this case, sort of the arc of the story in 2001, is that Russell Tank, in his 70s, suffering from what we believe is a mental illness and other cognitive decline, lets all 700 of his farm acres of his farmland go fallow for an entire year, growing 7, 8, 9 foot thistles on both sides of the road as far as the eye could see. No reasonable farmer would ever do such a thing. No reasonable person would allow their land to do this. And that's the Russell that we're facing, making sense of what's in Russell's mind. The contestant in this case, Sherry Castro, was the oldest daughter of Russell Tank. She retained an expert witness, a neuropsychologist from Fargo, to explain what was going on. He evaluated in a forensic manner the evidence that he had before him, including medical records as well as collateral information from witnesses, and determined that Russell Tank had a paranoid delusional disorder, which was essentially a lifelong condition. He was distrustful of banks, the government, local shopkeepers, anybody that could in some way be found to be distrustful in his mind. He would keep to a narrow set of conversations, talk about his Model A's, about the weather, about farming, and that was about it. He lived an isolated existence a few miles south of Britain. His house was not even a house. It was an apartment-like facility inside of a machine shed. He had a limited education. On top of this, from 2001 through 2000, or through the rest of his life, he had a progressive cognitive decline, which at some point is declared a vascular dementia. Layering all these problems upon each other made Russell someone who was clearly impaired, made him vulnerable to manipulation, and the situation was ripe for someone to take advantage of. From those facts, we determined that there was a reason to bring a contest of this will and challenged it on several grounds, including undue influence by Jason Bender, who was the local neighbor who stood to inherit essentially a $4 million farm based upon his newfound friendship of Russell Tank. I'm going to track the issues as they're listed in the booklet, but I'm happy to jump around as the court would ask. The first issue that's listed in the booklet is about whether a Rule 50B motion must be tied to the substance of a Rule 58 motion. I'll give some background to this. I don't think that this is an issue that is upon which this case turns. There's more issues that are essential, but it's one of those issues before the court in this setting in the law school that might be useful as a teaching tool, and I think this case will eventually stand for the explanation of what a Rule 50A and a Rule 50B motion are. From the moment a case begins, the trajectory of a civil case is towards a jury trial, and there are interrupting factors along the way. These gates that we have adopted, a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment, and then a Rule 50A motion prior to the verdict, on a Rule 50B motion following the verdict. After this court's holding in Brinkman, the standard for all of these is the same. It's a de novo review, meaning we look at, you know, a cold record. We don't apply anything to it. We don't weigh facts or evidence. We just look to see, for example, on a motion to dismiss, is there enough to sustain a theoretical claim? On a Rule 56 motion, if this evidence was in front of this court, or in front of a trial court, could a fact finder find a judgment? 50A, should it go to a jury for a judgment? 50B, was there enough evidence for the jury's verdict to be supported? This case, I think, is the only one of its kind where the case has already been up on the same standard, on a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment, and now is being questioned after the fact on a Rule 50B motion. If this case was good enough to go to a jury and sustain a verdict as of January of 2020 when this court released its opinion, and Justice Jensen, your roadmap for what a prima facie case would entail, it's hard for me to envision what changed in that amount of time. Our argument, at least in issue one in the briefing, is that the only question before this court is as to element four influence. We have susceptibility to influence, secondly, opportunity to influence, third, a wrongful disposition to influence, and fourth, a clear result. The only matter that was challenged in a Rule 50A motion by Mr. Rasmussen at the time of trial was on the fourth element, whether this is a clear result. Our argument is that he's bound by that, and we can't go any further than that.
By failing to respond in your reply brief and by bringing it to the attention of the circuit court. Could you address that?
The first one I'll address is whether we waived it at the circuit court level. The rule is, ordinarily, you waive it by not bringing it up. At the time of the hearing on September 8th of last year, I told the circuit judge that I thought we needed a transcript if we're going to do something so serious as to throw out this verdict. That transcript would have helped us line up what the motion was at the time and make sure that it matched what it was. At the time we were doing that motion, it was 6 or 8 weeks down the line. Memories were fuzzy. My notes weren't that good, and so I missed the issue. Had I had a transcript, I certainly would have had the issue. It's an issue that can be cured on appeal relatively easily, and so I would say this is one of those cases where, although ordinarily it's waived, perhaps this is one where it's not. I'm not sure that I waived it in the reply brief or in our briefing. I pointed it out. I think that it's, in our opening brief, that 50A and 50B need to be tied together. I think it's a rule of law. My only concern is if we adopt it as a rule, it probably will lend to more litigants filing these kitchen sink 50A motions so as to make sure that we don't miss something on a 50B motion later on. A remedy for that would be to require these motions or encourage them to be in writing so that, I think it's a little harder for an attorney to put something in writing that's not realistic. Reed recognized at the time of, prior to the jury verdict, that we had evidence on elements 1, 2, and 3. That was reasonable and that was expected. And I think he was at least permitted to try on element 4. Ultimately, though, I don't think this case turns on this first area, because ultimately what we then ask is, was there sufficient evidence in the record to sustain the verdict on elements 1, 2, 3, and 4 on susceptibility, opportunity, wrongful disposition, and a clear result? They're not contending an issue on elements 1 and 2. And so really all that's before this court is a question of whether there is sufficient evidence to sustain a verdict on elements 3 and 4. In paragraph 43 of the Tank opinion that this court already issued, which is the law of this case, this court said that a jury could disbelieve Bender's explanations about the rent, and if so, use that as evidence of a wrongful disposition. We did that. We provided them with the evidence. I believe that the jury disbelieved Mr. Bender, and that would be sufficient to sustain this verdict on element 3. In addition, however, I have a list of 5 or 6 things that we presented. They're in the briefs, and I cataloged them all. The Gask-Jolen case, G-A-A-S-K-J-O-L-E-N, stands for the proposition that persistent efforts to gain control or custody of a testator's property can be used as evidence of a wrongful disposition. The record is replete with examples of this. Mr. Bender convincing Russell Tank, a secretive man, to reveal the locations of his buried cash, then mapping the money, and then keeping the maps and their significance secret from everybody in the world. Convincing Russell to put money on deposit with his wife, which started as $5,000, and as the trial transcript indicates at page 498, had grown to $117,000 by 2012. This is a man who distrusted banks and who was burying his cash. The ongoing secrecy of the rental transaction is an example of evidence in the record that would support a finding of a wrongful disposition. Becoming Russell's power of attorney, meaning gaining control over his property, would be an example of a wrongful disposition. The trial court excluded the moldy money evidence. Jason spending buried money that smelled moldy, apparently had been buried. The only reasonable implication was that he was spending Russell's buried money before Russell died. The suspicious cash transaction was excluded, and Bender being named as a beneficiary on various accounts and entering into a five-year written lease with Russell after 2012. All this evidence was excluded, but there was ample evidence even without that to sustain element three. Element four, a clear result. This court said, in its opinion, paragraph 45, that the sudden change between Sherry as a beneficiary in 2001 and Jason in 2004, without any other explanation as to what went wrong between Sherry and Russell, would be evidence that would support a clear result. At this point in the trial, then, Mr. Bender had the opportunity to explain all of the things that must have gone wrong between Sherry and Russell between 2001 and 2004. There really isn't anything. Sherry had a continued similar relationship that she had had previously between those time periods. She was not able to come back to South Dakota as often as she would like. When she did, she would spend an hour or an hour and a half with him. She would send him cards. She would send him letters.
What was the evidence between 2001 and 2004? How many times did she see her father?
That's right. I believe it was in 2004 that she did, which would be about 2 or 3 months before the will.
So it was one time?
One time.
Right. Otherwise, there was no contact between father and daughter, correct?
Not no contact, meaning she continues to send cards and letters.
From father to daughter.
From daughter to father.
Right, but I'm saying there was no contact by father to daughter in that period of time, correct?
Nor in the previous either. So whatever that is, daughter to father of cards and occasional visits, as of 2001 was the pattern, and it was enough for Sherry to inherit a $4 million estate. So there was at least testimony disposition towards Sherry sufficient to sustain that. Now, that is the evidence that this court pointed out we could use. We used it, and that would sustain this verdict. That's not the only evidence. I've got a list of nine things that are in the record, that are in the briefs. You've got the rental timing, the farm rental timing. Meaning that Jason becomes the tenant on Russell's land at the same time or roughly the same time that he decides to buy a Model A and ingratiate himself with Russell. You've got the characteristics of influencers that Dr. Swenson talked about, emotionally isolating people, turning trusted people into untrusted people, an outsized sense of entitlement based on what you're giving to the victim. You've got discussions taking place between Russell and Jason Bender in the hospital, in the weeks leading up to the 2004 execution of the will. You have Jason Bender admitting that if Rennie knew about this, meaning if Rennie were to come along and find out about this will, this rental arrangement, that it would likely lead to Rennie and Russell getting back together. The ongoing secrecy associated with this supports a clear result. Bender's partial admission at trial, when I asked him point blank, does this will look like what it would look like if you were involved in this and had procured it by undue influence, and he said it could have. The estate of Borsch says that the will itself is evidence of a clear result. And then you have Jason Bender's persistent testimony, which is at odds with everybody else's observations of Russell Tank. Jason Bender said that Russell had no memory problems, no cognitive problems, no mental illness at any time, including up to 2012. Rennie Tank testified that Russell was confused about what he owned in 2002. Darren, a neighbor, testified that Russell forgot that he had seen him earlier in the day, Thanksgiving of 2001. Gene Coulter, with no vested interest in this case, saw Russell for a decade and a half and said that it was a constant decline over the course of the entire time that she knew Russell. And Russell Tank himself told his medical providers that he had memory problems. Between 2001 and 2012, why would Jason Bender disagree with everybody else? That lends itself to the supposition or the evidence, the inference that there is something going on here that he is hiding and keeping secret. Top of all that, at the very beginning of this, are conversations that take place in Russell's house over a card game in the year 2000, prior to Rennie's ejectment, where everybody is chiming in, including Jason and Jason's wife, about what a bad guy Jason is. About what a bad guy Rennie Tank is. Jason doesn't intervene. Jason lets these take place. A true friend of Rennie objects, points it out, and leaves. Jason Bender stays and participates in those conversations. All of this is evidence that a jury could have used to determine that there was a clear result of influence in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Brentrell. Mr. Rasmussen, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Judge Tilson. May it please the court. Two experienced, well-respected circuit judges have handled this case. They both determined that the contestant's evidence of undue influence was woefully weak. Judge Myron, who originally had the case, granted summary judgment with regard to all of Sherry Castro's claims and the claims of her siblings as to mental incompetency or testamentary incompetency, insane delusion, and undue influence.
Counsel, you referred to two judges determining the evidence was weak. Is that the standard that we apply to a Rule 50B motion?
Not exactly, Your Honor. But Judge Portra then, in sitting as a trial judge, made the determination that there was no substantial evidence to establish undue influence, either under Elements 3 and Elements 4 of the test. So to a certain extent, yeah, I mean, you still have to have Mr. Brentrow, in his briefing, uses the term more than a scintilla. Well, a scintilla is some evidence.
And but our cases say that we don't give any deference to the trial court on that determination, including in this procedural posture post-verdict.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Our cases say very clearly we don't give any deference to the trial court in this kind of determination.
No, I'm not saying that you do, but you certainly can look at the record as Judge Porter did in sitting through the trial and conclude that there is no substantial evidence to support Elements 3 and 4 of the undue influence test. That's the point I'm making. But yeah, it's a de novo review that you do. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about whether the Element 3 was properly considered by Judge Portra. I'm going to just rely on the brief as far as that goes. But in the end, I'm not sure it's that significant because we've still got Element 4, and there's no question that the 50A or 50 that was raised in the 50A motion. We both, in our briefing, spent a lot of time talking about this court's opinion in the first case, the appeal from the granting of summary judgment. We obviously have different views of that case and how it should relate to the trial of this matter. In that case, the court did reference a number of the things that Mr. Brentrow talked about as potential evidence of undue influence. Significantly, virtually all of those things and virtually all of the evidence that the appellant cites in her brief are things that happened 5 to more than 10 years after the disinheritance in 2004. This court, in particular, I think there's dispute amongst the parties as to the interpretation of paragraphs 44 and 45 of the court's opinion in the Tank case. In In paragraph 44, the court recognized the In re Blake's estate case, which said that consistency between wills and a period of time between the drafting of the two wills strongly negatives the presence of undue influence. In this case, we have two virtually identical wills that were drafted more than 8 years apart. But the court then went on to state, as counsel for Ms. Castro mentioned, that the court raised questions about the fact that the will gave Sherry everything in 2001. 3.5 years later, it disinherited her. In paragraph 45 of the opinion, then the court stated, aside from Bender's increased involvement with Russell, there is nothing in the record to suggest that anything occurred in the relationship between Russell and Sherry from 2001 to 2004 that would have caused Russell to disinherit his daughter.
But counsel, with regard to your point that the evidence referred to in Tank 1 may have been things that happened after 2004, when we're looking at the element number 3, is there legal authority that says that you can't look at conduct after a will is changed as, you know, additional context of what might have been going on in that general time frame before, during, after?
Well, I don't think this court has ever specifically addressed that issue. It has as far as the issue of testamentary capacity, but as far as element 3 of the undue influence test, I don't think it's been addressed. Now, would I say that something that happened very shortly after the execution of a will might not be relevant? Yeah, possibly. But when we're looking at things that are happening 5, 10, more than 10 years later, after 2004, I fail to see how that can really be relevant.
And well, we're not considering the evidentiary issue in this appeal of whether it should have been admitted or not admitted, are we?
Well, I don't think you should. They've asked that you do. I don't think you should. But I think the point being is that in the court's prior opinion, some of those things were mentioned. And I think in light of the evidence at trial, those things are not of any significance at all in determining.
It would be asking us to weigh the significance of that evidence, would it not? Or are you suggesting that as a matter of law, admitted or not admitted, we just can't consider it?
I think in this situation, it just should not be considered at all. Yeah,
we have cases within the realm of our Rule 404B jurisprudence that says and holds that other acts of evidence, which is different, can be admitted, need not be prior bad acts. So other acts evidence that occur after something that is highlighted at a trial can come in and can be used and is relevant, at least under 404B. Does that bear on anything?
I really don't think it does. That wasn't an issue. I guess there could be an argument along those lines, but that was never an issue that came up at trial, and I don't think really is significant to this appeal. What I think is significant is the court's statement about there was nothing to suggest a change in the relationship between Russell and Sherry between 2001 and 2004. Then the court went on to mention that, in fact, right before that statement, that Mr. Bender had begun renting farmland from Russell at a reduced rate. Well, the evidence at trial disputed that, or it's uncontradicted, that statement is not, from the court's opinion, was not correct. And I'm not saying that that's not what the state of the evidence was at the time of the summary judgment, but the evidence at trial clearly showed, and that's highlighted in the brief, and it was not contradicted, that the rental rate that Mr. Bender initially charged Russell beginning in 2002 was at or even above the market rate at that time. But more significantly, and this testimony was highlighted by Mr. Brentrow, was the testimony of Sherry. Because again, as the court stated in paragraph 45, there was nothing at the summary judgment stage, nothing to suggest that anything had occurred in the relationship between Russell and Sherry. But that Sherry's own testimony at trial showed or established that there was something that occurred. That being that in the summer of 2001, leading up to that time, she periodically had visited her father. Summer of 2001, she visited him. That was a few months after the 2001 will had been written, giving the estate to her. She didn't see him again for 3 years. Summer of 2004. By her own admission, or by her own testimony, it's clear that that visit did not go well. She testified that she brought a 3-year-old daughter with her, and her father ignored that daughter. Russell Tank lived for 12 more years. Sherry never saw him again. Clearly, there was something that happened between 2001 and 2004. That last visit was a disaster.
Well, counsel, all of this came out in front of the jury. And in fact, your client testified twice, both adversely and then in his own case in chief, probably spent several hours on the stand in front of the jury. Isn't it the jury's obligation to determine the weight and the credibility of the witnesses in this case? And in essence, the trial court set aside the jury's verdict. And that's what's brought us here.
Well, I agree. And that is, you were correct. But the trial court does have an obligation under Rule 50B to look at the evidence, and if there is no substantial evidence to support the plaintiff's, or the, in this case, the contestant's claim, a Rule 50B matter of law judgment is appropriate. And that's what Judge Portra did. And by mentioning this evidence about Sherry, it's only to highlight, you know, the issue the court raised in that prior opinion about there being nothing to indicate there was a change in the relationship. Well, there was. And that's why, you know, my focus, based on the court's prior ruling, has been on what happened between 2001 and 2004. And the evidence of undue influence in that time frame is essentially non-existent. It just doesn't exist, and that's what Judge Portra saw. All of the things that they reference, whether it was allowed into evidence or not, are things that occurred long after and do not impact the decision that Russell Tank made in 2004 to disinherit Sherry. I think the same rationale that the court used in determining that the other three siblings were disinherited in 2001, despite the fact that the court was presented with this evidence of Jason's supposed ongoing decade-long effort to unduly influence Russell, that didn't change the court's feeling in affirming Judge Myron as to their disinheritance in 2001. The same reasoning should be applied here for the disinheritance of Sherry in 2004. That they're really, this case, when you come right down to it, all the four contestants, or I guess there was just one contestant at trial, but all four siblings, they had no evidence of Russell unduly Jason unduly influencing Russell in any manner. There was testimony that Jason was good to Russell. He was a friend. And really what it comes down to is their speculative testimony from Dr. Swinson, essentially to the effect that, well, Russell was of such a mind that you couldn't really be his friend. The only person that would be a friend would be somebody who was trying to influence him unduly. And that just doesn't make sense. And that's what Judge Portra saw in the evidence that was presented at this trial. It was based upon speculation window.
Well, counsel, are you saying that we shouldn't look at any of the evidence from before the 2004 will, or you're just saying none exists?
I'm saying virtually none exists. Yes. I mean, the evidence that the prior opinion cited was the reduced rental rate. Well, the trial showed that wasn't
true. But, you know, that was summary judgment. And then that was before us in summary judgment in Tank 1. And, you know, now it went back for a jury trial. We've had a multi-day jury trial where the evidence has been established and fleshed out.
And what I'm saying is that in that jury trial, there's virtually nothing that would allow a reasonable jury to imply that undue influence occurred between 2001 and 2004 when Sherry was disinherited. And that's my point is that's the key.
But that's not what the jury was asked to decide. They were asked to decide the 2012 will. And so don't they get to, from 2012 prior, look at all the evidence that took place?
Yes, I think they do. But I think the way Judge Portras saw it is that the key, again, was Sherry's disinheritance in 2004. There's nothing substantial to establish that that disinheritance was caused by any undue influence. The rest of it after that, although I move that the evidence not be allowed, but it was allowed. But I think when you consider the fact that the 04 and the 2012 wills are the same, with the exception of a couple of vehicles, that's the key point, is that prior to Sherry's disinheritance, there is nothing, no substantial evidence to indicate, to allow anybody to imply that there was undue influence.
Well, counsel, go ahead.
Wouldn't that be an issue then if this goes back and you probate the 2004 will? And then you'll say at 2004 we'll look backwards and see if there's undue influence at that time, just because you got a shorter time length.
Well, certainly that's a possibility. I think the record is clear enough that the Judge Portras should be affirmed for what he did. But if it goes back and we have to try the 2004 will, I guess that's what we'll do. I think my time is about up, so I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Mr. Printro, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Chief Justice, let's address the 2004 will first. That was briefed by us in part of issue 4. I got an email from Reed Rasmussen on the eve of trial saying, no, we've abandoned any claim about the 2004 will. So we proceeded with trial with that understanding. We crafted the jury instructions with that understanding, and it is now too late for Mr. Rasmussen to resurrect the 2004 will. Judge Knopf, you're correct that the jury was entitled to review the entirety of it. In fact, that is what will contest cases, undue influence cases, say. All of the circumstances, they're fact-specific. It's very difficult to compare this case to any other will contest because they're so unique, so fact-driven, and when we look at all the facts, we can't compartmentalize them.
Counsel, this, you know, as to issue 4, whether the actual will showed evidence of the effect of an undue influence, this is kind of a not all case have this situation where you have two wills. One of them, both the 2004 will is the one where he now doesn't include children and everything goes to Mr. Bender. So under just looking at element 4, and I understand you disagree, but indulging your opposing counsel's argument that the relevant evidence is then what happened up to 2004 when that change in the will was made, what are the acts in the record or the evidence, because you mentioned a number of them, but which of them were pre-2004?
You've got this unusual set of visits to the hospital shortly before this will is executed in 2004. Jason Bender convinces Russell apparently to invest money with his wife. This is a man who buries cash. That happens in 2001. This rental situation starts.
With regard to the rental situation, so I think it was pointed out on summary judgment, we didn't have the evidence that then was developed at trial with regard to what the market value, or maybe it was, I guess I don't recall that being part of the summary judgment record, what the market value was at that time.
Right.
So if it was close to market value, is that significant?
So if it starts at close to market value, then it's just interesting to note. It doesn't stay close to market value.
Well, but this is my question about pre-2004.
So this gets to an issue that I hope this court clears up in this opinion about what evidence is permissible for a wrongful disposition. We already know that the testator's mind for a reasonable time before and after is admissible, which makes sense. If this were about a burglary that was being committed, nobody would say, well, everything after the burglary is out.
But I'm not talking about element 3, element 4.
Yep. they all fit together. If the wrongful disposition evidence, I mean, and that's what the rental rate issue is wrongful disposition evidence. The secrecy of it continues on as it becomes less and less market rate. The reason why we look at the entirety of the circumstances is, first of all, that someone's wrongful disposition is not likely to change. And so if we find evidence of it at one point in time, circumstantially, it proves what it was at another point in time. A will is a special kind of theft. Just because I'm in your will doesn't mean I get any money today. I get it when you die. If I have a wrongful disposition for theft or taking someone's money, other types of actions related to that are happening while they're still alive. Inter vivos theft, if you will. I would say circumstantially that people get bolder as they go if they haven't been caught for years, and so they're going to make more mistakes, like spending moldy money in public, things that would eventually get you caught. And so when you look at the totality of the circumstances, the jury is looking at this entire ecosystem of circumstances. These cases are hard to prove with direct evidence, and that's what all of the cases continue to say. We don't hamper litigants by requiring specific direct evidence or specific evidence for specific time frames. The jury can consider all of that.
It seems to me like element four is something where you could assume all of this is being done, that he had a wrongful disposition, had the opportunity, but if element four requires, you still have to show that the effect of that wrongful undue influence or disposition did not result in a will that was ultimately different than what Russell would have done in the first place. You still haven't met all of the factors. That's my understanding. Is that consistent with what you are arguing here?
So, Justice Devaney, I think that the answer is that even element four relates to the other elements. Someone's susceptibility, meaning how impaired or how vulnerable they are, is going to make it is going to affect element four, meaning the clear result. Like how much would it have taken to manipulate someone into doing whatever this is, to overcoming whatever this their will was. As far as
you need to wrap up, Mr. Brim.
Yep. Trying to find a succinct way to say this, Justice. I don't think that we parse it out. You look at all the circumstances, and they're interrelated. And the clear result, I think, probably is shown best by Jason denying the truth of simple, obvious things, evidence of a guilty mind, denying that Russell had any problems, and keeping all of this secret from his family, from Russell's family. All of that would let a jury conclude that this is something that was a clear result.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. That will conclude our October term of court here at the law school.